Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this Ordinary General Meeting. Copies of the minutes of the Ordinary General Meeting held on 28th of November 2005 have been displayed on the Institute Notice Board and will be taken as read. May I sign the minutes as a correct record? Thank you. I'd like to start by extending a particular welcome to two guests here tonight. Professor Paul Klumpis, Professor of Accounting at Tanaka Business School, Imperial College London, and Tom Crossland, Manager of Pillar 2 Policy at the Financial Services Authority. You're most welcome, gentlemen. I'd also like to welcome any other guests and personal guests of members here tonight, and to say that you're all very welcome to join in our discussion if you want to. Before starting the main part of the evening, it's my great pleasure to award a prize this evening. The prize is the Watson Wyatt Prize for Financial Economics, awarded to the best performing student in subject CT8, the Financial Economics paper, for the April 2005 examination diet. The award of this prize has been made possible by Watson Wyatt LLP offering to provide sponsorship to the profession. In addition to providing the prize, Watson's will also sponsor other educational work undertaken by the profession. And the winner of this prize, who is here with us tonight, Nirav Mojaria of Ernst & Young. We now have a presentation of a paper by John Exley and Andrew Smith entitled The Cost of Capital for Financial Firms. And I'd like to invite John Exley to introduce the paper for us. John.
Thank you. Mr. President, guests, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming here tonight to discuss our paper on the cost of capital for financial firms. This is a summary of what our paper is about. We start by considering why cost of capital matters and why financial firms are special in relation to cost of capital. We then consider the advantages and disadvantages of some popular measures of cost of capital and propose ways of improving these existing approaches. In particular, we point out the advantages of frameworks that take full account of a firm's market value. This slide shows some reasons why cost of capital is relevant. I think you'll be familiar with many of these, but I'd like to focus just on the last of these. For most economic goods, the amount you choose to buy depends on how much it costs. However, many firms' capital calculations are based on the notion of economic capital needs. In other words, most economic capital models focus on the benefits of capital in terms of low ruin probability. However, we think that capital decisions can be improved by also considering the cost of this capital at the same time. Most of the literature on cost of capital considers typical firms whose businesses are financed by equity and debt issued in the capital markets. The typical firm is shown here, where it'll have plant, machinery, intellectual capital, and the like. Modigliano and Miller famously explained why the value of a firm is unaffected by how it's financed. In other words, as shown, the value of a firm is the value of debt plus the value of its equity. The result works because non-financial firms can often rearrange their finances, for example, the ratio of equity to debt, without any immediate impact on the value of the underlying business. Financial firms are substantially different, however. This is because their capital providers are also their customers. For a financial firm, reallocating capital between business units may translate physically into cutting off existing customer relationships and initiating other relationships with new customers. So including the debt in the cost of capital calculation is troublesome. Now, because of the difficulty of measuring total cost of capital for a financial firm, many firms are focused on other measures, for example, return on equity, that's the column on the right-hand side, or more recently, return on risk-adjusted capital. And what I'm just going to consider now is some problems with these approaches. First of all, if you just consider return on equity, does return on equity predict total returns? In other words, is the return on equity a good measure of the required shareholder returns? Well, if we look at this diagram here, which compares non-life total shareholder returns with all industries, we find that the return on equity for non-life businesses was below all industries for every year from 1990 all the way through to 2004. However, on a total return basis, that's looking at the return on the equities, non-life companies actually outperformed the all industries over this period. So there's a bias in the return on equity measure that's very important for financial firms, and I'll explain where that bias comes from in subsequent slides. Another popular alternative to this is return on risk-adjusted capital. This looks at how much capital you need to allocate to a particular lines of business to lead to a particular probability of ruin for that business. And here we have examples for Fortis, where different lines of business, as shown by the pie chart, are allocated different amounts of economic capital. Now, the problem is that these amounts of economic capital provide the denominators in the capital of return on economic capital, return on risk-adjusted capital, which means that businesses that have small allocations to economic capital apparently have very large returns, for example, as shown in investment services. Now, if you take this at face value, it would suggest that you could add value for the firm by closing down the merchant banking business and instead applying capital to the investment services business. But, of course, the problem is that economic capital alone is not the measure of the shareholder investment in the business. Investment services have involved substantial investment in building up the brand name, in building up customer relationships. You can't simply measure the shareholder investment in a business by the economic capital that needs to be held. So there's substantial problems also with looking at economic capital. As I've hinted, there's a missing component in these previous calculations, both in the return on equity calculation and the return on risk-adjusted capital. The important missing component is what we call the franchise value. As we show by this diagram, there's actually three different components of shareholder wealth, which is, i.e., the excess over the liabilities. That's, first of all, the economic capital. This is the capital required to achieve a certain low probability of default. Secondly, the free capital above that point. And finally, the franchise value. This is the value of the in-force business. We regard the value of in-force business as part of this franchise value. The franchise reflects the investment of the shareholder in the entire business. The economic capital calculation, so let's just look at some biases in other measures, and to investigate this we've got two examples. First of all, an example of personal accident business, and secondly, an example of catastrophe reinsurance. In the case of personal accident business, the economic capital requirements are quite small, whereas in the case of catastrophe reinsurance, the economic capital required is extremely large. This reflects the fact that the losses on £100 of catastrophe reinsurance premium, that the losses on catastrophe reinsurance premiums is more volatile than the corresponding volatility of personal accident insurance. You might imagine that you need to charge a higher profit loading on catastrophe reinsurance on account of this. However, returning to the issue of franchise value, the personal accidents market shows greater customer loyalty and is heavily dependent on distribution. This is because much of the business is cross-sold to credit card holders, And once a policy has been started, the premium is a small monthly deduction that the cardholder hardly notices. The different nature of these businesses is reflected in the market capitalisation of the business. The high franchise value of the personal accident business should be a clear signal to the business owners of the margins required to be seen in the premiums charged. Our two examples therefore have the same market capitalisation. If the businesses were of similar risk, then the shareholder required returns would be the same in pounds in both cases. In fact, in this case, the personal accident is probably higher risk since it holds lower free assets in relation to the economic capital requirements. The effect can also be seen in the new business effect on shareholder value. The chart here shows a possible new business effect on shareholder wealth. The effect on the net assets is a profit at inception from writing new business. There will be an effect on economic capital reflecting any additional risks assumed. So as shown, the economic capital increases, and the assets increase by the profit at inception. The subtle part is the effect on franchise value. Several aspects come into play here. First is the familiar value in force effect. The market gives credit for future margins not immediately released from liabilities. However, rather than being expressed in absolute terms, this needs to be considered relative to the value that the market already gave to this business before it was incepted. In other words, part of this was already reflected in the franchise value. More often than not, particularly if there is a profit at inception, the comparison of the value in force to the previous allocated franchise value results in a franchise value write-down, as in our slides. The third effect is even more subtle. Our extra block of business has made the firm slightly more risky. This increases the rate at which the market discounts projected profits. You might think that this is a second-order effect, but in fact it matters because the reduction applies to all businesses too, not just to the block we're valuing. The discounting effect gives a rationale for profit deductions expressed as a cost of economic capital, which we commonly see used in pricing practice. So finally, let me just outline the key components of what we regard as a better approach to capital costs. The diagram summarises the three different things people might mean when they talk about cost of capital. The first is the shareholder total return requirement. This is measured on the total shareholder wealth. In other words, net assets plus the franchise value. The second is tax and agency costs. There is no definitive model of these, but they are plausibly related to the net assets. That's the free capital plus the economic capital. Thirdly, we have the risk discount rate, which results in a cost for business units that contributes to the economic capital requirements. In our paper, we describe how the franchise value could be modelled by looking at what we describe as asset swap margins and liability swap margins. In a way, this is quite a neat combination of three quite important separate branches of insurance over the last few years. What you see is that the three components we have here is, first of all, the economic capital calculation, which turns out to be important in determining the risk of default of the firm. Secondly, we have friction costs, which has been a source of significant research in recent years. And thirdly, we have the franchise value, which is related to asset swap margins and liability swap margins, which are revealed by securitisation of business. And our framework combines these into a model of the cost of capital for financial firms. Finally, the diagram taken from the paper illustrates how the model can be used to establish optimal capital structure for a financial firm. As we point out in the paper, there are two contrasting conclusions from previous models. First of all, just looking at the embedded value approach, because the embedded value approach involves discounting future cash flows using a return that's greater than the returns on the assets, you find that the more assets that you hold, the lower the value of the firm, so that's the downward sloping line. Secondly, if you look at the return on risk-adjusted capital, this assumes that as long as you can keep reallocating capital to a business that has a return above its risk-adjusted cost of capital, the more you allocate to that business, the more you increase the value of the firm. Now, those two lines don't unfortunately intersect at a point that gives you the optimal capital, but what we propose is a framework that balances two different concepts. First of all, the lower the capital you hold, the higher the ruin probability and the higher the risk of loss of franchise value. Secondly, on the other extreme, the more capital you hold, the higher the frictional costs and the greater the losses due to frictional costs. And we find that we therefore arrive at an optimal capital structure between these two points. In summary, cost of capital is important but difficult to measure, especially for financial firms. Return on equity and return on risk-adjusted capital are not always good indicators of shareholder returns. The important point is that shareholders demand a return on market capitalisation, not just accounting assets or economic capital. An allocated economic capital turns out to be relevant, not as an entire solution, but because it measures the distance to default, which is an important input into the full model. Finally, the optimal capital structure balances frictional costs of equity capital against the default effect. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I'll now ask Dick Gray to open the discussion.
President, guests, ladies and gentlemen. It was with some trepidation that I started to read an Exley Smith paper, given the pedigree of our two authors. And whilst the cost of capital probably touches many of us, you, like me, may not count it as one of your core competencies. And that's perhaps not surprising, since we haven't seen many papers on the subject. And consequently, the prospect of opening the discussion on the subject offered something of a challenge. However, I have to say that I found this a most enjoyable paper, and anything less challenging may not have satisfied the academic fraternity, and anything more theoretical may have deterred those of us with a more practical view on the subject. The authors, I think, have given enough for everybody to stand and make a contribution to the discussion, and I hope and encourage you to do this. Sections 2 and 3 in particular provide ample material in this respect. By contrast, sections 4 and 5 extend the discussion and offer an interesting and compelling framework for optimising a company's capital base, and one that will particularly appeal to academics and practitioners in the field. I'm looking forward to see how the discussion develops. It is without an apology that I admit that I read this paper from the perspective of the financial management of a life company rather than that of a general insurance company or a bank. It should not be forgotten, though, that this paper has regard to all financial firms, and again I encourage views from across the range of financial institutions, and whether they be they proprietary or mutual. Certainly as a generalist, I found this paper particularly left me wanting to deepen my understanding of the subject. As the authors point out in their introductory section, the cost of capital matters. It interacts with return on capital, because once a company has capital, it can only borrow more if it provides a suitably has proved that it can provide a suitably high return on capital. If it fails to produce that return, then shareholders look to extract their capital as soon as possible and as efficiently as possible, with perhaps the one exception of mutual life offices, where it's unlikely that enough mutual membership power could force such an extraction. I was surprised to read in section 1.1.6 that some regulators are considering whether firms should be required to hold capital to meet the cost of any capital tied up for solvency purposes, as traditionally the regulator's ability to retain capital within a financial institution does not, on the face of it, require them to consider the effect on the providers of capital, as our authors go on to observe in 1.2.5. Section 1.3 establishes that traditional corporate finance parlour, or a typical firm, as John just called it, that bank depositors and insurance policy holders would not be considered as providers of capital. Capital for life companies, they observe, is straightforward, and there is equity and sub-debt and generally no senior debt, at least not within an authorised life company entity. For life companies, of course, there is new business strain, which is essentially a liquidity issue resulting from the investment in new business. And within typical firm and typical parlance, this can be financed with short-term debt or working capital. Given that life companies are increasingly to finance this strain through new business financing arrangements, be they cash or cashless, it is worth noting that rating agencies recognise working capital and might exclude this as a debt item from their capital models, reflecting its short-term nature. Clearly, though, it is an additional liability of the balance sheet, and I'd welcome the author's views as to whether there is such a thing as working capital and perhaps what its status is on the balance sheet. Is it capital or just another liability? The paper highlights the role that the cost of capital plays in traditional embedded value calculations and notes how market-consistent embedded values are now emerging as a preferable way of measuring the value of in-force. This development in financial theory has started to establish itself, and it is therefore with interest that I read sections 4 and 5 that extend these market-consistent approaches to an alternative determination of the capital base and the quantification of franchise value. Section 2 questions the return that shareholders require and introduces CAPM. In particular, 2.1.3 mentions that the weighted average cost of capital can be minimised by raising as much debt as possible. Of course, in a perfect world, raising more debt would increase the volatility of your equity return and hence push up your cost of equity. This should give rise to a zero-cost gain, except for the arbitrage that debt is tax-deductible. It is this tax relief that theory suggests makes it sensible for a non-financial institution, i.e. a corporate, to raise as much debt as possible. Although even for corporates there can be a point of inflection in that the cost-benefit equation changes once one moves from being investment grade to becoming a sub-investment grade issuer of high-yielding bonds. Of course, major financial institutions can't entertain the latter as its customer base relies on a strong investment grade. The reference to Hancock et al. Describes the way that replication portfolios can be used to determine shareholder returns, and many UK actuaries through their work on the realistic balance sheets will be familiar with this. Franchise value is then introduced together with the interesting concept of a franchise insurance premium, which is then carried forward to refine the capital model described in Section 4. The idea of attaching a cost to the loss of franchise value in the event of failure appears to have a sound logic to it, and I'd certainly welcome the thoughts that you may have on this concept. Section 3 introduces the main theme of the paper, namely return biases and the approaches to removing these. The idea that ROE ignores the implications of the capital sunk in a firm's intangible assets is intuitively obvious to life actuaries, given the importance of a life office's VIF in its embedded value. Rating agencies will recognise VIF as soft capital and give, for example, 50% credit in its estimate of a firm's capital base. Consequently, I would suggest that the inclusion of franchise value in the determination of total shareholder return is second nature to a life office actuary. The paper introduces some interesting thoughts in this respect. Companies do set shareholder return targets, and there is a circularity that plays against management when it comes to life offices. Very often, a life office's in-force portfolio is seen as a drag on shareholder returns. Of course, a traditional embedded value basis uses a shareholder discount rate to determine VIF. In the paper's terminology, a low discount rate will maximise franchise value and reduce a firm's total shareholder return. This gives rise to the question, what value should you place on VIF to determine the franchise value and hence eliminate accounting bias? Adjusting a discount rate to achieve this is horribly circular, making it clear how important it is to calculate franchise value another way. Consequently, the development of market-consistent valuations are to be welcome. The paper discusses the calculation of economic capital at some length, as well as the various tiers of capital and RORAC. There is plenty here for the floor to express their views on, as the use of these measures, when they should apply, and perhaps when they don't make sense. I personally believe RORAC can be a very useful tool in establishing the value, for example, of hedging a risk position against the alternative of backing it with capital. Of course, there's going to be discussions about how the capital released has been calculated and to what risk tolerance. but it sets an objective target against which the cost of servicing this capital can be computed against the cost of de-risking. The paper then moves on to asset swaps and liability swaps, and it outlines how a life company could swap its asset cash flows for, say, LIBOR, and its liability cash flows for something less than LIBOR. Here we enter new levels of thought provocation. It's also where I had a stroke of luck, because last Wednesday I finally decided that I'd call Andrew Smith, and we were fortunately both found ourselves on the same plane back from Zurich on a Wednesday morning, so I have a benefit over you that I've had a short tutorial, which the ticket holders of Rose J2M also benefited from. Even without this tutorial, I found section 4 very compelling and, on the face of it, complete. But even with the tutorial, I would not consider myself accomplished enough to have the skills to rigorously critique its hypothesis, although I did try. Therefore, I hope the academic contingent from the floor can provide views for the rest of us to reflect upon. The methodology does look to have the potential to provide some valuable insights, such as indicating the optimal level of leverage. Figure 12, which is the figure that John just showed, illustrates the franchise value increasing indefinitely with leverage under the RORAC model. Clearly, this is the case if there are limitless opportunities to deploy it and earn the same RORAC. However, in my mind, I see additional capital being deployed in such a way that it provides a progressively decreasing return on capital. In my view, there's a strong case that a capital should keep on raising capital whilst its cost of capital is less than the incremental RORAC. Hence, a life company might experience a decreasing increase in franchise value as it borrows more so as to include additional lower-yielding investments. Hence, in my view of the world, the dotted line diagram in that graph would be sort of convex-shaped. In terms of the formula that the authors develop, I wonder if there would, in practice, be irrevocable losses of tax credit. I'm not sure that in insolvency you would necessarily lose all of this asset. A life company is likely to carry on in some form rather than be formally wound up, and as such, some of these tax assets ought to continue to have value. From the practical perspective of doing the sums, the credit default swap, binary credit default swap rate, would need to relate to a senior creditor, and many life companies have not borrowed on such a basis. Clearly, some have borrowed on a sub-debt basis, and the credit spread on that could be adjusted to impute a senior debt CDS rate. However, most subordinated debt has a coupon structure such that it's expected to redeem on its first call date, typically 10 years from its issue, and this is reflected in its market price. Consequently, you would need to extrapolate credit spreads over the very long term. And this extrapolation is also likely to be true in respect of aspects of the liability swap and possibly even the asset swap. But this is to miss the point. The suggested methodology is not going to be a precise science, but one that could potentially produce valuable insights into a company's value. I would dearly have liked to have seen a worked example included within the appendix, and would encourage the authors to provide such an example in any future literature that they may produce on the subject. And on that note and that plea, I open the discussion to the floor. Thank you.
Thank you, Dick. The discussion will now be open to the floor. In a moment, I'll just ask those of you who may be thinking of joining in the discussion to let me know. Before doing so, I should mention that you shouldn't let the fact that the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing. All speakers will be given the opportunity to see their comments and edit them somewhat before they are published in the British Actuarial Journal. And I know to my cost that that's a very useful thing to do. If for any reason you're not able to make your full comments here tonight, then you may submit them in writing after the meeting. We do have roving microphones available, and you could speak from the main body of the hall using the roving microphone, or if you prefer, you can come up to the lectern to make your contribution. My instructions also say that you should turn off your mobile phone if you wish to speak, as mobiles interfere with our sound system. It is not sufficient to mute the ringing tone. Your phone will still try to talk to its base, and this is picked up by our equipment. I've got a list of a number of names of people who've indicated in advance that they'd like to speak tonight, but could I just ask for a show of hands of all those who are thinking they might contribute to the discussion, so I can get a sense of how many speakers we might have. Can you just put up your... Okay, fine. In that case, I'll start with the one names on my list, and we'll pick up the others and then throw it open to anybody else who feels moved to speak. If you could state your name clearly before speaking, could I invite Cameron Farugi? Is he here?
Thank you, President, and thank you as well to the authors for this very useful and complete paper. This paper emphasises the need to understand the context when using the phrase cost of capital. I've come across three distinct uses of this phrase. First, when setting top-down hurdle or discount rates to value a stream of future profits, in particular to value assets where there is no market price. Depending on the situation, this would include concepts such as the cost of equity, possibly set using the capital asset pricing model, as well as the weighted average cost of capital, or WACC approach. This definition is a classic corporate finance definition of cost of capital, the return investors require on their investment given the risks involved. When setting the WACC, the authors point out some pitfalls management could make. For example, in section 2.6.2, the use of book values rather than market values as weights to set the discount rate. I'm glad to say that the insurers I have worked with have not been falling into such traps when setting the WACC. The second use of the phrase is in the embedded value context. Here, the cost of capital is an additional accounting provision applied as a discount to the capital required over and above the basic regulatory reserves. This somewhat artificial split of required capital is simply a result of life insurance regulation. Terminology starts to confuse because one way of allowing for risk in an embedded value is to use the top-down WACC approach. So you're using a cost of capital approach to set the discount rate, and then applying it to calculate a different cost of capital provision. The third use of the phrase relates to frictional costs. These are a component of both the author's total company performance measurement model, described in sections 4 and 5 of the paper, and also market-consistent embedded values. With both these models, the allowance for market risk is made automatically using a bottom-up approach, cash flow by cash flow, and the phrase cost of capital is a reference to frictional costs. Which frictional cost to include is a matter for debate. I would always argue for taxation and investment management expenses as a minimum. Regarding agency costs, I would agree with the author's comments in section 5.8.4 that some allowance for agency costs is already made by setting expense and other assumptions with regard to recent experience. Setting appropriate best estimate assumptions, allowing for the full impact on shareholder value of fluctuations in experience, is my preferred way of allowing for non-market risk in the valuation. This may avoid or minimise the need for an additional agency cost factor. Regarding financial distress costs, the biggest sign of financial distress for an insurer is a sudden inability to write profitable new business. That is why, in making commercial decisions, you should always consider both the impact on the embedded value and also the impact on the value of future new business. And by doing this, you move away from the simplified straight line in figure 12, page 43, presented earlier this evening, to a curve much closer to the author's model. Finally, I'm glad to see the authors recognising that market-consistent embedded values are one of the big ideas to come out in recent years on insurance management. This is a key building block for their corporate model, breaking down their model into manageable component parts. This breakdown, looking at both the embedded value and the value of new business, enables firms to make sensible commercial decisions. Thank you.
Professor Paul Crumpets.
Yeah. President Guest, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to comment on the paper. Australian background academic, so you'll hear my kind of slight views on this topic at odds with some of others people. I mean, obviously, investors, regulators, fund managers, employees concerned about their performance face strong incentives to assess cost of capital for valuation, budgeting, compensation, fund management decisions. But there is little consensus as to how cost of capital should be calculated for financial firms, and in their paper, Exley and Smith provide some fascinating new insights into the cost of capital issue. My comments will just focus mostly on some technical, methodological issues. There are three approaches to the cost of capital, which I'm going to discuss, and I'm going to just fit Exley and Smith into those three. The first is what you might call the standard coffee table textbook approach, the kind of standard kind of corporate finance textbook approach, where you're really concerned about valuing the firm in terms of calculating beta. And clearly, you know, expected return on capital using standard asset pricing models such as the CAPM and Farmer and French free factor model. I think Exley and Smith kind of dismiss this approach and really move on beyond that. Of course, they criticise beta because it's really the only measure of systematic risk, and so clearly for an aggregated entity, when you see their financial statements, you're not going to realise that you really want to calculate the beta for various different business segments. But cost of capital researchers have actually done this, and they've got around the problem by using what's called a full information industry beta approach, where you can actually observe the market value beta as actually being the weighted average of some unobservable betas of the firm's underlying business segments. In fact, Robert Merton and others have derived an asset beta for the firm's operating asset as a function of both the equity beta, a pension asset beta, and debt and pension liability betas. They then use that approach to gauge the efficiency of the stock market in pricing pension risk, which is surely an issue of interest here in the UK. But Exley and Smith really are much closer to what I would call actually an accounting approach, because they introduced the concept of franchise value, which accounting standard setters would really regard as a kind of intangible asset that you would then add on to the net tangible assets that auditors worry about. Strangely, that concept is not really fully defined in my view, even though its really concept is quite crucial to accounting. I assume in actuarial parlance, this concept is really what you might call appraisal value, the sum of embedded value, value in force plus new business. In terms of the accounting link, this appraisal value is really seen in the non-financial firm setting as being what we might call inherent goodwill, which is then kind of feeding into accounting-based models of cost of capital by we just add on to the book value of equity the future residual income, or EVAs, under various assumptions. And this, I think this is where we have a second problem, because franchise value is kind of being used in actuarial science quite a lot nowadays, and is arguably part of a fair valuation replicating portfolio. But unfortunately, the concept is not really so well defined for other kinds of financial institutions, such as banks and fund managers. And moreover, many of the non-financial firms actually exclude franchise value. Instead, they just treat it as an intangible, so we might come up with some kind of real option in order to help us explain the difference between market and book. Interestingly, market-to-book ratio is actually much smaller for financial firms than it is for real firms. Franchise value is also going to be quite highly affected by leverage and solvency. But as we know, banks and insurers have at their disposal various tricks of value illusion and other financial engineering devices to help them manage their regulated leverage. By contrast, when we talk about leverage for non-financial firms, the theory says that these firms are obviously subject to onerous restrictive covenants. Now the literature will use unlabored beta to do the calculations. Again, that procedure is less likely to be acceptable for financial firms whose assets and liabilities will be measured using a mixed attribute market-based or fair value system than for non-financial firms who would use a more conservative basis for measurement. It's also not clear from the paper what are the accounting principles or the gap that underlie the cost of capital. Are we going to use, you know, the UK gap? Are we using IFRS? Are we using some form of regulatory gap, or are we using US gap? And clearly, some of these and many of these are now being reported together by firms in their financial statements. Gap quality, in fact, can have a significant effect on the measured kind of reliability of the assets. I'd like to now just go on to the final approach to valuation, which I think is what Exley and Smith are also using, which is what I call the financial economics approach. And I think this approach is slightly different because it's actually modelling explicitly the assets and liabilities of various kinds, including the franchise value. And the difference from the accounting approach, which is implicit, is that in this case we're actually developing the concept of a securitised portfolio. And Exley and Smith use that approach to help them develop a hedge portfolio of assets and liabilities. Clearly, that is then supplemented with this notion of a credit default swap derivative to help them price default risk and then come up with various scenarios. I think the main criticism here I've got as an accountant is that clearly for a financial firm, there's a full complexity of various bundled or unbundled insurance and investment type contracts which firms manage and which are now being disintermediated through new financial products, and clearly they're subject to evolving accounting rules on financial instruments and insurance contracts, so it's a bit more complexity there that we're not modelling. My final conclusion from this discussion is if we want to move forward, we probably want to have a combination of both the asset liability approach and the accounting cash flow approach as a more modern risk-based approach to measure financial performance and develop better concepts of cost of capital. So we can really think of a broad financial economics perspective where you've got three elements: franchise value, net tangible assets, which is just the net market value of assets minus the present value of liabilities, and a third variable, which I call the default put option. The main approach of this third approach is that, over the Exley and Smith approach, is that really you're seeing that the net tangible value is completely independent of what kind of assets a firm has and is independent of insolvency risk. Moreover, the default put option will separate out all the credit risk issues from the hedge portfolio, and it's really just treated as a put option gameplay with regulators that we model separately. So in summary, I think to make further progress in this area, Exley and Smith have made a great start. What we need to do is a more consistent approach to reach consensus about what reporting standards we should set to model the hedge portfolio. What's the mathematical context? How do we model uncertainty? What's the probability structure, the solution structure required to implement the valuation model? But second, and perhaps finally, we also need standards to consider the implications of this model for decomposing various sources of earnings so we can think about earnings as being within a more comprehensive performance framework for financial firms. And I think it's here where we need a bit more rules and kind of guidance about developing more consistent, auditable and reliable estimates that will help us come up with cost of capital. And I think Exley and Smith's paper is a helpful and timely contribution to this end. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. I now invite Ian Farn to make a contribution. Is Ian?
And thank you very much for a very interesting and well-written paper. I'd like to talk a little bit on the author's discussion on amending biases and accounting measures of return in Chapter 3. The paper points out the basic but often overlooked fact that the return on book equity of any company is fundamentally dependent on the proportion of its total value which is recorded as its book equity. So a fund manager with very low book equity but high franchise value provides a high return on equity. A life insurer reporting on an embedded value basis where a large proportion of total value is recorded as book equity will return a relatively low return on that equity. Another way of looking at this bias is that part of the return which is being divided by the equity is not actually being generated by that equity at all, but by the portion of total value which has been omitted. This differentiation of returns by source is easier to apply in some industries than others. However, one clear example is for a life insurance company, which again, using embedded value basis, you can see the new business value component of the return represents return on the goodwill or franchise value, not a return on the in-force portfolio or embedded value. To track or to target new business values as a percentage of embedded value, as is implied by the calculation of an ROE ratio, does not seem logical. Why should the two be related? This is, however, what is implicitly it was implied by imposing a uniform return on embedded value across a global life group. So how should returns on embedded value be targeted? A simple return approach is to segment the total return into different components and set targets appropriate to each. The in-force component of return rewards significant analysis of the market and insurance risks to which the embedded value is exposed. The nature of those risks and their market prices give a good guide as to the appropriate target returns. The setting of new business value targets is more difficult. While financial risk and return analysis might suggest how you avoid destroying value, the question is more often about how much value creation is required. If new business targets are to be meaningful to management in a geographically diverse group, they need to reflect many factors, essentially those encapsulated in the franchise value of the company or business unit. These would include the growth and profitability prospects of each market, the historic performance of the business unit, and the scope for operational improvements, often as represented by competitors' results. So benchmarking your performance against peers often has an important part to play. Finally, I'd like to note the inevitable conclusion of many of these arguments concerning return on franchise value, that increasing value for shareholders is primarily a matter of managing and exceeding their expectations. Thank you.
I'd now like to invite Chris O'Brien.
Thank you, Mr. President, guests and ladies and gentlemen. I'm delighted that we have the paper presented by John and Andrew, another step forward to a better understanding of the links between accounting, valuations and risk. We really wonder why didn't we think about these things 10 and 20 years before. I have three comments, firstly about economic capital and the other two in the area of who bears risk. The authors refer to economic capital and to RORAC, and then throw in some doubt, referring in 379 to extreme percentiles not being the main determinant of expected market returns, with economic capital being the amount required such that a firm has a specified probability of meeting a defined liability over a defined time horizon. However, not only is that specified probability an extreme percentile, it is only one particular percentile. It is value at risk measure at 99% or whatever is being used. Now, value at risk is fine as a measure of risk if the 99th percentile is what we're interested in and not anything else, but value at risk gives no weight whatsoever to other risk levels, and in particular whether within the tail the losses are relatively high or low. Indeed, VAR is not what we would now call a coherent risk measure. It suggests, therefore, that value at risk is not a good measure to use in economic capital, although it is still the main risk measure shown in the reports and accounts of banks. We could take the argument further and then question whether individual capital assessments for insurers, and perhaps solvency too, are right in focusing on the capital requirements that arise just at one percentile. There may be better ways of measuring risk and determining the required capital. Second, who bears the risk? In section 5.10, the authors refer to why firms should spend money on managing risk. If a firm has diversified shareholders, this is not entirely a straightforward matter. However, there are valid reasons for spending money on managing risk, for example, to reduce the cost of financial distress, or to increase franchise value by enabling the firm to be more attractive than otherwise to customers and suppliers, who then may be more willing to enter into long-term relationships with the firm. However, risk is also borne by managers. They typically have non-diversified wealth and may prefer a more secure firm in order to protect their jobs and their earnings. There are a number of empirical studies of why firms manage risk, for example, the extent to which they buy derivatives or buy insurance, and also evidence on why firms undertake acquisitions that are expected to reduce the volatility of their earnings. This evidence has found that firms do differ in the extent to which they reduce risk, depending on, amongst other things, how the remuneration system for the managers responds to risk, for example, using salary, shares or share options, which are all different in this respect. What this means is that it's managers' interest that can be relevant in risk management decisions. However, it also implies that it is open to shareholders to incentivise managers if they feel that managers are being unduly risk averse. Lastly, it's also customers who can bear some of these risks. A feature of many financial services firms is that they issue long-term contracts, or at least contracts that have a long-term dimension, such as a bank account, which is likely to last several years. It may be that customers are bearing some of these business risks. This is clear in the case of with-profits life insurance policies, but may apply elsewhere as well. If a bank or investment firm suffers some adverse event, it may be able to increase the charges it makes to its customers. In a competitive market, the customer would move to a firm that has not suffered those adverse events. However, markets for financial services products are not always competitive, partly as the products are often complex and the customers ill-educated. So consumers can end up bearing some of those risks. Indeed, if we were to think about mutual financial services firms, which includes building societies as well as mutual insurers, then, yes, the customers there are bearing risks. However, customers are unlikely to have diversified portfolios and therefore have a different perspective from shareholders. Capital market theory has certainly enhanced our understanding of how shareholders can manage risk to increase value, and we must be grateful to Andrew and John for their work on this. We maybe also need to consider how mutual financial services firms use their capital and manage their risks.
Thank you, Chris. We've had a written contribution from David Dulloway, and I'll ask the Honorary Secretary if he would read it to the meeting.
Yes, this is a written contribution from David Dulloway. I'm sorry that I cannot attend the debate on the author's excellent paper tonight. There are many areas that I would like to comment on, but I shall restrict myself to expanding on the author's discussion of RORAC, or Return on Risk-Adjusted Capital. RORAC is a performance measurement approach used in many large financial conglomerates, often to compare the performance of such different businesses as life and general insurance, banking and fund management. It is usually defined as some form of annual profit measure, possibly embedded value earnings of life insurance companies, divided by some measure of the economic capital required to support the business. The authors bring out a number of reasons RORAC is a poor method of performance measurement for financial firms, including biases in the determination of profits and in the determination of economic capital. I would like to mention another problem with RORAC that is not addressed in the paper, that RORAC does not correctly reflect investors' views of the return required for taking different types of risk. It is generally accepted that a well-diversified investor requires a greater return for taking on market risk, which they cannot diversify, than for taking on a similar amount of non-market risk, which they can largely diversify. Any performance measurement system should reflect this fact. However, RORAC implicitly assumes that investors require the same return on all types of risk. We can see this if we consider two life insurance products defined so that they both generate the same level of profit and require the same amount of economic capital, but have different risk exposures. For example, consider a term assurance product mainly exposed to non-market mortality risk with a with-profit bond mainly exposed to market risk. As both have the same economic capital, for a given level of profit, both will generate the same RORAC. So under this performance measurement approach, both seem equally attractive. Yet most investors would prefer to be writing the term insurance product than the with-profit bond, as the term insurance contains less market risk. Without adjustment, RORAC will therefore lead companies to take too little diversifiable risk and too much market risk from an investor's perspective. It may be possible to adjust RORAC either by using separate hurdle rates for each type of business or by risk adjusting the profit to strip out the cost of risk, as in the so-called RARORAC, risk-adjusted return on risk-adjusted capital approach. I wasn't looking forward to that bit. But this is moving a very long way away from the idea that economic capital can be used to allow for risk. After all, either of these approaches requires an entirely separate performance measurement system for valuing risk, which is the problem RORAC was originally meant to solve. RORAC effectively assumes investors can't diversify away non-market risk. That is, it considers valuation from a company rather than an investor perspective. This might be appropriate for a partnership, a venture capitalist, or indeed if we are concerned for the benefit of senior management, whose fortunes are largely tied to the firm they run. It is not appropriate for a publicly traded company.
Tony Silverman.
President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to start by saying that it is very good to see the Institute engaging with this sort of subject. The paper is part, I think, of a wider debate about cost of capital, and it's obviously, as other speakers have said, a very good contribution to that. I'd just like to focus on two or three particular points, if I may. Paragraph 2.3.2 says that the normal required shareholder return calculations put life insurers at a disadvantage and suggests they're unfair to life companies, at least in down markets. And this is a related point to that made by the previous speaker. The phenomenon described is just part of a long-standing and well-rehearsed argument as to why fund management companies, and perhaps more recently life insurers, indeed do deserve a beta of more than one. And there's a very strong argument that any business whose underlying earning capacity is directly impacted by markets should have a beta greater than one. Paragraph 2.4 is headlined Introducing Franchise Value. I wasn't quite sure. That just seemed a bit of an odd headline. I'm sure we all know what franchise value is, and perhaps introducing Return on Franchise Value would have been better. In paragraph 2.6.2, the authors suggest most WACC calculations use as weights the accounting values of equity and debt rather than the market values of these terms, and that this is perhaps unsatisfactory. However, I'd like to emphasise that the reasons for using accounting numbers in other industries are not necessarily those stated in 2.6.3 when one's looking at the accounts of other industries. In other words, they're not because market values of subsidiaries are not available at all or to avoid volatility. The primary reason is that management or analysts are usually assessing the success of decisions around the deployment of organic cash flow. Is the company making good use of capital? Is the question that people are trying to answer. And the market cap is simply not available as organic cash flow. It's simply not what management has invested. A large part of the franchise value is genuine goodwill, as I'll mention a little bit later on as well. The accounting equity is used to a degree as a proxy for what management and investors have put in. In other words, these calculations are a substitute for the cash flow return on investment, which is alluded to in 3.1.8 as itself not really accessible to direct calculation, certainly by an external analyst. And of course, the CFROI is close to the internal rate of return that many of us will, of course, be very familiar with. However, the problem is that in life insurers, accounting equity, whether it's GAAP or MCEV, is not close enough to the amount of cash invested to produce a meaningful answer to that calculation. And indeed, if the accounting ROE has too distant a relationship with the CFROI, which I think is where we are in the life insurance industry, then that is indeed a serious drawback for the fundamental relevance of the accounts to users. This unfortunate feature has been discussed elsewhere, including, if I may say, in a recent article in Professional Investor magazine by myself. Section 3, and to a degree the rest of the paper, tries to put things right by constructing an ROE that equals the total shareholder return. Apart from the transparency problems, the question is how to assess, and I'm sure it's right to have regard to the overall share price impact, but the question is how to assess that share price impact. And a large part of the answer, I think, will remain the IRR. There's much more I would like to say, but in conclusion, these reservations obviously should not obscure what is an extremely valuable paper, which we are very lucky to see presented. Thank you very much.
Peter Needham.
President, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank the authors for a very interesting and topical paper, and to add a few comments on the subject of managing risk, capital and value, primarily from the perspective of life insurers. Firstly, why is this subject so important and currently attracting so much attention? Well, over the last 5 years, the life industry has focused heavily on risk and capital, developing better tools to help measure risk, and taking action to minimise losses and preserve its depleted capital base, largely defensive measures. Over the next 5 years, hopefully, the industry will be refocusing on creating value, and it will need effective risk management and value measurement tools to do this. Thus, the topics covered by this evening's paper are very relevant. Why, therefore, does it appear to be so difficult to come up with appropriate metrics and measurement tools to assess performance and returns for life companies? It's clear that some measures derived from other industries are at best inadequate on their own and at worst may drive inappropriate or value-destroying actions. The answer, in part, is because the risk to which the financial services industry is most exposed, such as asset liability risk, credit risk, and insurance risks, are often different from the risks which are most important for other industries. We also have to recognise that within financial services, there are two views of everything: the policyholder and regulatory perspective on the one hand, and the shareholder perspective. And we do easily confuse these two views. So, for example, when thinking about risk, the regulators or policyholders are concerned with the risk of ruin, whereas the shareholder perspective, the concept of risk and return is more appropriate, i.e. what is the required shareholder return for a particular type of risk. Similarly, there are two different concepts of capital, well, at least two. The regulator or policyholder view being the capital available to secure their benefits, and the shareholder view being the total market value of the company. So there seems little point in using regulatory, or for that matter economic capital, to measure shareholder returns. This would only be appropriate if these were good proxies for the total market value, which is often not the case, especially for a company with any significant franchise value. So we find that management are faced with a bewildering array of metrics, which often causes great confusion. An effective financial management framework needs to ensure the metrics used are consistently calculated and appropriately used. They should be based on a clear and consistent underlying methodology which links risk and capital and value together. Any such framework needs to be theoretically robust but also practical to implement, and it should drive consistent value-creating decisions across all areas of a company and also at all levels of the business. I believe that a market-consistent, value-based approach can meet these requirements. Finally, I'd just like to comment on how these changes in financial management are already influencing the way in which some companies are running their businesses. The most obvious examples are in the area of asset liability management, where increasingly sophisticated dynamic hedging and other techniques are being used. Most companies are also changing the way they price for risk in their new products. And last but not least, in many M&A transactions, market-consistent embedded values are an important part of the array of information influencing transaction prices. I expect we'll hear a lot more about these topics over the coming months and years. Thank you.
Professor Richard McVeigh, I think you had your hand up earlier.
Thank you, President. As some of you know, I'm a chartered accountant, but have the honour of being an honorary fellow of your institute. I regret, having heard the presentation and skimmed the paper, which is obviously excellent, that I haven't had a chance to read it properly beforehand, so these comments are based primarily on the presentation and a few things I've checked. I've been busy teaching my students this afternoon about the proposals from the IASB and the FASB on the future of accounting for business combinations, most of which appears to be sheer lunacy. But it's obviously very relevant because it's all about accounting for goodwill, and I think what I understand now, goodwill is the franchise value, so we need to get it right. Three fairly brief comments, primarily directed at increasing the understanding between accounting literatures and actuarial literatures and financial economics literatures. In section 3, the authors convincingly argue the dangers of looking at returns on equity based on just the accounting numbers and not building in the fact that shareholders are expecting a return on their market value of their investment. But nevertheless, there is some feedback between these things, because the market value of the investment on which they are expecting a return has only been set by expectations that the company is going to be able to deploy its internal assets and activities sufficiently well to earn a return which justifies that market value for which the shares will trade. So the question there really is, how far do the numbers within the accounts provide information that enables the market to set a realistic value for the firm which it can then deliver a appropriate risk-adjusted return on? And obviously, if it doesn't, and those expectations change, that market value will change. Still in section 3, there's a reference to Ezra Solomon's paper in 67 as being one of the earliest demonstrations of accounting errors. I think, given notice, I could find some from 1867. So maybe we need to go back a bit further than that. And that brings me to my last brief comment, which is in section 4, 4.2, and in particular 4.2.12, and Paul Klumpy's alluded to this as well, about a theorem corresponding to Modigliani and Miller's theorem. Not that dividends are irrelevant, but the timing of dividends is irrelevant. Similarly, there is an accounting theorem that not that accounting is irrelevant, but that the timing of accounting is irrelevant. In other words, it doesn't really matter whether you recognise the profits now or later. At the end of the day, you can only recognise the same amount, and the authors have captured this theorem very well. Unfortunately, it isn't new. There's a lot of work in the last 15 years or so, particularly by James Olson at Columbia, which has spawned a whole literature on this accounting irrelevancy theorem, which it would be worth exploring a bit further. So I think my overall impression, not based on a deep reading of the paper yet, is obviously this is extremely helpful. And perhaps I could close the observation by saying there is obviously a growing relationship between actuarial literature and financial economics literature, which is having an impact on practice. There is similarly a growing relationship between accounting literature and financial economics literature, which is having an impact on practice. Clearly, what we need is a growing relationship between actuarial literature and accounting literature, and then we shall have completed the triangle. Thanks.
I think William Hewitson had his hand up.
President, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about how some of the concepts and ideas in this useful and interesting paper might be applied in the context of the ongoing discussion within Europe on what's called Solvency II. For this Solvency II project, the basic principle that many of us are looking at is that the provisions for insurance liabilities within the financial returns should be essentially the amount that would be needed to allow a transfer of the business on commercial terms to a well-diversified third party with a good credit rating. These provisions would therefore be assessed on market-consistent principles for hedgeable risks, but with appropriate margins to cover the possible misestimation of means of parameters for unhedgeable risks as viewed over the outstanding duration of the policies. There are then at least three possible conceptual approaches still being considered, I believe, within Europe that could achieve this purpose. Namely, the first option would be a percentile approach to the assessment of risk margins for longevity, general insurance claims, and other risk factors, which might, for example, be set at a level sufficient to provide 75% confidence that claims can be met, this being the current benchmark that's been suggested by the European Commission. Or indeed, it could be set at some higher level of confidence, as we understand some European supervisors are keen to see. The second option, which will be of interest in the context of this paper, is what's called a cost of capital approach, which has been advocated by some of the larger European players within the industry. And this is based on the projected cost of servicing either the economic capital or some regulatory capital as held by firms each year. However, this approach would still need so much more developmental work, and this is an area where I'm sure the profession could make a useful contribution. The third option, which comes in part from some proposals, I believe, from the German insurance industry, is really a sort of US GAAP-style approach, principally apply for life insurers with some fairly arbitrary margins, say 15%, added to the best estimate rates for mortality and persistence in expenses. Then, in addition to the assessment of these provisions in the financial returns, there would then be added a regulatory capital requirement designed to ensure that with a high level of confidence, such as perhaps 99.5%, that there would be sufficient assets to cover the life insurance or the insurance provisions in the 12-month time. In other words, that for the setting the capital requirement, there would be some sort of stress test or scenario or standard formula designed to ensure that in the event of this very adverse event, in 12 months' time, there would still be enough assets to cover your market-consistent value of liabilities. So I think one way forward on all of this that might be seen by many people here would be the industry developing a sound but pragmatic approach to determining an appropriate level of economic capital to support their business and indeed for individual business lines, which might then be taken into account both in the pricing of their policies and in the overall management of their business. However, I sense that perhaps such an ideal might still be quite a considerable distance away from us at the moment. Meanwhile, though, the percentile approach to assessing provisions does not appear to be very popular with many people in the UK industry, and the other alternative cost of capital approach that's been advocated by some of the larger players is still in need of considerable further development. Accordingly, my own personal opinion, we might very well end up then with some standard approach within the EU for the setting of provisions, which, at least for life firms, might comprise as a proxy for the percentile approach some US-style pads attached to the various assumptions for the unhedgeable risks such as mortality, persistency, and expenses. But perhaps at the same time, with an option for firms to convince the regulators that they can apply some internal modelling approach instead, perhaps based on this cost of capital. The internal modelling approach, regulators would though be looking to see that such models were fully integrated into the running of the business. In conclusion, I'll just add then that there is of course still time for the profession, both through the group consultatif in Europe and the IAA, which is assisting some parallel work in the IAIS, to inform this ongoing international debate. However, the cost of capital approach to the assessment of provisions will need to be developed fairly rapidly now if it is to be taken forward as a viable option within Europe. So I hope that this outline is helpful. But I should add, of course, that the views I've expressed tonight are my own and not necessarily those of my employer. Thank you.
Thank you, William. I now throw it open to the rest of the audience. Is there anybody who would like to make a contribution? Yes, one hand at the back there and then two in the middle.
Richard Badden. President, ladies and gentlemen, this paper sheds light on the trickiest issues for value management of financial services. Much of my work is in the merger and acquisition context, so I daily deal with the challenges of producing values and comparing those to market values. I particularly welcome the efforts that the authors have made to reconcile their performance calculations to market value. If we step back and look at embedded value, though this looks like a simple idea, there are tricky issues in practice, including the allocation of tax and expenses, including irrecoverable tax and changes of tax basis as part of a transaction, allowance for the firm's own possibility of failure, which people tend not to look at, and quantification of the costs implicit in the three tiers of capital. It is tempting to push all the difficult issues into the goodwill box. Of course, if we think that agency costs or possible corporate failures are too hard, we may convince ourselves that these effects are only future business effects and therefore stop thinking about them in the context of embedded value or in pricing computations. Worse still, these difficult items may turn out to be balancing items. I'm not the first to notice or comment how similar in numeric terms embedded value on a European basis is to traditional embedded value. This sometimes seems to happen because an increase in stated guarantee cost is associated with a removal of whatever agency cost or operational risk cost is embedded in the risk discount rate. Now, in a transaction context, parking hard questions in the future new business box is no answer at all, particularly in the context of recent transactions where people are looking at closed blocks of business. Like Andrew and John's paper, we are interested in the firm's whole value or enterprise value. It is pointless to persuade yourself that agency costs are zero just because it's easier to deal with in that way, or because the assumptions offset elsewhere in the computation. Today's paper offers an exciting way forward. What matters is a firm's total value, which includes anticipated asset and liability margins net of tax, less the tricky items of agency cost, and yes, credit risk, the credit risk of default to the shareholder. Nevertheless, you can estimate these on an aggregate level by calibrating back to market value. Value in force is then an attribution of that franchise value, considering the marginal impact of the business, what happens at the valuation date. So in summary, this framework gives a unified measure of value, which allows us, probably for the first time, to fully understand the impact on shareholder value. That's not to say that we shouldn't consider economic capital and all the other important regulatory measures, but at the end of the day, when we're looking at an enterprise, we need to know the value to the investors. This framework gives us a robust market-consistent technique which moves us significantly on from embedded value to a broader enterprise value approach. So again, I'd like to thank their authors for their contribution.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Tim Sheldon. Banks and insurance companies already employ a wide range of capital measures. We have accounting equity, market capitalization, risk-based capital, regulatory capital, economic capital, and now for UK insurers, we've also got individual capital assessment and its offspring, individual capital guidance. Do companies really need yet another measure, optimal capital or optimal capital structure, as proposed in this paper? In this paper, the authors make a strong case for the adoption of this new capital measure. There is, of course, much similarity between some of the currently used measures of capital. For UK insurers in particular, risk-based capital, economic capital, ICA, ICG, are really variants of one measure based on value at risk, and that's the capital required at some chosen confidence level and time period to meet the risks accepted by the business. It seems likely that over the next few years, regulatory capital will move to a risk-based capital approach. And the purpose there is to demonstrate to customers and shareholders that the company holds sufficient assets to meet its liabilities to the former group with an acceptable degree of confidence. But does it make sense to use risk-based capital or economic capital for other purposes? The paper gives an example of the use of economic capital in a RORAC framework as used by many companies in published report and accounts. Here, the aim of demonstrating attractive rates of return on capital is consistent with a desire to show that net assets are a multiple of economic capital. Reducing economic capital improves both the apparent rate of return on that capital and its cover. And maybe the old Form 9 ratio will at some stage be replaced either with the ratio of net assets to economic capital or perhaps by the number of significant figures in the chosen confidence level. While the flaws in this approach, including accounting bias, are exposed by the authors and indeed in other relevant references in the paper, It's interesting to note that in the example given in Figure 4 and Table 5, the total shareholder return is actually very close to the return on equity for all industries over the period. Does that suggest that on average return on equity gets it right, or is this just coincidence? Whatever the answer, the use of RORAC to take business decisions leads to the development of less capital-intensive business lines and strategies aimed at reducing capital requirements, neither of which will necessarily result in maximising shareholder value. From a shareholder perspective, a different framework is required. Demonstrating an adequate level of risk-based capital or economic capital is a necessary requirement in order to continue to trade, but it is clearly not the whole story. First, shareholders would like a return on market capitalisation, that is the share price, and not just on part of it. Secondly, shareholders should be interested in maximising the value of their firm relative to the capital contributed. This, as the authors demonstrate, is equivalent to maximising the franchise value. Most companies or insurance companies now use embedded value techniques to monitor and report progress in enhancing firm value. Embedded value is good at measuring how an uncertain franchise value is being converted to in-force value through the writing of new business, but it needs extending, at least for internal management purposes, to embrace the management of franchise value. The search for a model of total firm value and the optimal capital structure requires a calibration of the various components of firm value, that's net assets, value of the in-force, future new business, and frictional costs, to the observed market value, and a model of how the value depends on the capital structure or amount of capital and gearing. This has presented a formidable challenge, as it involves two unobservable items, future new business value and frictional costs, both of which depend on several parameters. The hedge model developed by the authors provides a way of estimating some of the frictional costs, in particular the main component of financial distress costs, that is the loss of franchise value, from other market data, thus reducing the number of parameters that need to be inferred to give the desired fit to market value. This should make models for firm value, frictional costs and capital structure more robust and easier to apply in practice. I very much hope that this excellent paper will encourage more companies to investigate this approach to capital structure and develop its applications in pricing and in the other key financial decisions that our clients make. So thanks to the authors. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Any other contributors? Yes, David.
For the tape, I'll say that my name is David Wilkie. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I want to comment only on one quite small aspect of this paper, which is not an integral part of the author's argument at all, but nevertheless is put in without much comment. They put in Figure 1 in Section 2.1, showing mean equity returns in excess of T-bills from 1900 to 2000, quoted by from Dimsett et al.'s very large survey. A couple of things to note on it. They show the geometric and the arithmetic returns, and in most countries, in the sort of bottom three quarters of the table, the difference between these is about roughly 2%. It's just a minor point out the mean of a log normal distribution with parameters mu and sigma squared is e to the mu plus a half sigma squared. A median is e to the mu. The long term return is e to the mu. And the extra half sigma squared term is the sort of difference between the geometric and the arithmetic means. And with a standard deviation of 20% or 0.2, square that, you get 0.04, half it, you get 0.02, and that explains the 2% difference. You knew all that, you all knew that anyway, so there's no need for my saying it, but it's a bit redundant. However, the authors don't quite say that one should look at this table in order to find out what shareholders will require in future, but I do think it's actually very misleading. First of all, the final date for the period that Dimson looked at is 2000, and you'll remember that there was a very significant asset bubble in the last few years of that century, so that share prices the end of 1999 and for some time during 2000 were at very high PE ratios, or price dividend ratios, so very low dividend yields. And if you I don't know what the figures were for 1900, but I doubt very much whether the rating of shares in 1900 was as high as it was in 2000. So part of that return is to do with the asset bubble, and if you believe it, as it were, you have to believe that the asset bubble will continue and continue and continue in future until PE ratios or price go to even higher levels and dividend yields to even lower levels. A further thing is that the countries at the top of the list with the highest equity returns, Italy and Germany certainly, I'm not sure about Japan, but France also, had very high inflation during this period. Germany, extraordinarily high inflation after the First World War, and hyperinflation in 1923. Italy and France, pretty high inflation in the 30s and during the Second World War. It's interesting to note that the old Italian lira, the old French franc, which was one-hundredth of the newer French franc, the Swiss franc and the Belgian franc, all had the same value in 1900 and at an exchange rate of 20 to the pound. If we ignore the introduction of the euro, the exchange rates with the pound would now be about 3,000 for Italy, 1,000 for France, 50, 60 for Belgium, and 2 for Switzerland, which shows the difference in the inflation or the value of money in those different countries. Now, Treasury bills, it's a nice concept that Treasury bills keep up with the rate of inflation and give a small real return plus a compensation for inflation, but I don't think in practice they do, certainly not when inflation is exceptionally high. We had inflation 25% in Britain in the mid-1970s, but interest rates didn't get up to 28%. They were more like 15, I think 15 was the highest bank rate, maybe 17. Long-term interest rates were a little higher than that, but not over 20%. So share prices, on the other hand, although frequently they go down when there's an initial burst of inflation, keep pace with inflation in the long run, because dividends and earnings do go up in the long run in line with other prices, even in countries where there's been very high inflation. So the highish, what I think of as fairly high figures, are really the result in many countries of one or more bouts of inflation. And inflation doesn't come along sort of randomly year by year, but in attacks. You may have an acute attack or extremely acute attack like Germany, a fairly acute attack like Italy and France, or chronic attacks as most of these countries had during the 1970s and 1980s. And therefore, if one were wanting to use these figures as a projection for the future or as the required rate of return for the future, then I would say you're having to build in to your estimates a bout of inflation that you expect, but the rest of the market doesn't expect. I don't see how one can be consistent with market values on that basis. The market is not sensible if it is assuming, first of all, in relation to gilts, that inflation will be no more than 2.5% or so, but in relation to shares, that it'll be of the order of somewhere between 5 and 10%. And that's, I think, one can derive from these figures. And I just wonder whether, because companies of all sorts, financial and others, tend to use high hurdle rates for future prospects, that they are not finding those capital investments that would be worth doing, some companies returning capital to shareholders, because they are using too high rates of return for too high desired rates of return. Now, that, of course, is quite different from the whole discussion of the rest of the paper, which is really how you analyse the cost of capital. But if you're still wanting to work out whether an investment is profitable or not, you do need to put in some numerical hurdle rate, and one way and another. Managers may well, or top managers may well, like junior managers to use a high hurdle rate because the junior managers are very optimistic about their particular ideas, and this is just a way of counterbalancing optimism. But I think one does have to be careful about this sort of table and the sort of numbers quoted by Timpson et al. And by many other people. That's nothing to do with most of the rest of the paper, but I thought it worth saying.
Thank you, David. Any other contributions? We've got time for one or two shortish contributions. I see no hands going up. No? Okay. In that case, I'll ask Derek McLean if you'd like to close the discussion.
Mr. President, guests, ladies and gentlemen, thanks again to John, to Andrew, for a very valuable and important and topical paper, because capital got scarcer and is being looked at ever more closely as we move to greater scrutiny with things like Solvency II coming along. This isn't something that's going to go away. I'm grateful that my life is a lot easier in acting as the close of the discussion when there has been a sensible consensus around much of what has been said. And I'm grateful for a mix of speakers from a very different mix of backgrounds. If you'll excuse me, I will only pick on one of them by name, because it was the only person who asked a question that I know the answer to. The answer to Chris O'Brien's question, why weren't we doing this 20 years ago? As I was taking my actuarial exams at the time, I think I know the answer to that one. We were trying to work out at the time how to deal with inflation. So we were working out how in our revised accounting we could adjust both sides of what was going on to get some sensible ratios. Which, after all, is what an awful lot of the discussion tonight is still about, that we're still trying to work out what is the right return on what is the right bit of capital. So perhaps things haven't changed over that time, and we're still trying to answer that question, even though the question has changed its form slightly. I think there was some good discussion on how we get round this, and one near dissenting voice as to whether we needed yet another measure. I did note that there didn't seem to be much support for RAR-RO-RAC. Its principal benefit seemed to be as a challenge to the secretary of the meeting to read it out. A clear conclusion that we should support an emphasis on the return to shareholders, and I think that's quite right. From a personal point of view, I would say that one of the things I liked about the paper was its very readable style. I note that none of the people who have spoken so far picked out my favourite bit, which was 3.1.7's reference to the return on iron, which I thought was a very valuable ratio that we should be looking at in the financial sector. Having said that, I did notice that one or two contributors picked out what I thought was my least favourite part of the paper. I used to work for an asset management part of a rather broader organisation. And as we measured capital within the organisation, according to the capital that was allocated to the various divisions, I would be very proud of the fact that our division was very good at getting a return on capital. I'd almost be grateful for the regulators pushing that regulatory capital up a bit, because then we would still have the best return on capital in the entire business, but it wouldn't be by such a silly margin, because nobody ever quite believed us before. A couple of questions suggesting one of the things that I had written down in advance, which is, I think, all very clear as a theoretical thing. Love to see a worked example, which is a nice challenge for us to go back and look at a particular business and see how close we can get to a real worked example. one or two helpful comments in terms of agency costs and complexity of agency costs, particularly in the case of those agency costs that are less clear and those interactions that are less clear, so default costs and so on with mutuals and various inefficiencies that happen in the financial sector with some fairly strange stickiness of consumer behaviour. One technical point, which is I think is probably something that you might want to come back to, a couple of people queried, which is that in section 4.9 you refer to the zero recovery credit default swap. And I think that it's right that the thing that we're looking at there is not a conventional credit default swap, but I think that there is still, nonetheless, a subtlety in terms of what franchise value is still preserved, even at the point of the trigger. So although it's not a conventional credit default swap, it may be that we need to define the credit default swap in there in a subtly different way, at the very least, as at least one speaker mentioned, as to the possibility of the tax losses being valuable to somebody else, even if the franchise value in one or other of the brands isn't. And perhaps I don't know whether there's anybody that's here from a regulator involved in setting capital beyond the contribution we already had, but one particular challenge I would suggest going forward from the chart in section 5.7 seems to be that if we're looking at the interaction between tax and capital, what it seems to be saying is that the current tax regime works to encourage people to have less capital. And that would seem to be a somewhat perverse situation for those setting taxes and those setting capital ratios to work together. Now, I'm not sure how I would resolve that circularity, because you don't want something which lowers the tax take. It's hard for us in financial sector to demand that and be taken too seriously. So we need something which is probably neutral from a tax take perspective, but at the same time doesn't produce a one-off financial sector tax arbitrage. So I wonder whether there is something that we could take that further and come up with something which is a challenge too, as to try and resolve that in a way that gives greater security for any given level of tax take without that incentive that the authors point out. But particularly, I would like to thank the authors again and to thank those that have contributed to the debate.
Thank you, Derek. I'll now invite Andrew Smith to respond on behalf of the authors.
Good evening, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, and I'd like to start by thanking you all for your comments and observations on our paper. I'm just going to pick up a few points that have been raised in the discussion, starting with David Wilkie's comments about estimating long-term returns. And of course, he's absolutely right that estimating long-term returns over the next 100 years is even more difficult than estimating what they were over the last 100 years, and that's hard enough. And it's not surprising that it's contentious, because there are many different theories. The good news from our point of view is that we don't advocate a cost of capital methodology that requires you to do that. And in section 2.4, we instead suggest that for a financial firm, if you mark to market the performance of that firm, then the right thing to compare it to is the actual market return over the previous year on a replicating portfolio. So if, for example, you were a financial firm with a beta of 1 and no exposure to interest rates or any other market figures, then you might want to compare your return to the actual return on the stock market in the previous year. And you might say, wouldn't that introduce all sorts of volatility? Well, it does, both to the firm's return and also the market return, but of course those two cancel out. So you are then freed of this need to estimate long-term returns. I'm not saying that long-term returns are useless for all purposes, but for this particular purpose we could perhaps get round some of the difficulties that David had mentioned by going about it a different way. I'm going to comment now on embedded values and market consistent embedded values. We deliberately wrote our paper to apply to financial firms generally, but much of the emphasis tonight has focused on life assurance and the embedded value issue. And I just wanted to comment that we mustn't lose sight of how odd it looks to the outside world when we value liabilities prudently and then try to nudge them back to reality using a value in force adjustment. Imagine you're the finance director of a car manufacturer and your warehouse contains some blocks of steel and you know the historic cost of those blocks of steel. These are somehow turned into components and assembled into cars, distributed to dealers, and then cash finds its way back from the dealers through the system, and some of it gets back to you, and you use some of it for dividends, and some of it to buy some more steel, and some of it to pay workers and other things. And all of these you forecast meticulously month by month in a detailed business planning model. A life actuary now knocks on your door and tells you to extract from your planning forecasts the passage of a particular cohort of steel through the manufacturing, assembly, distribution, and cash settlement process. You have to discount the cash at the end and compare it to the book value of the steel, and the difference is the value in force of your steel inventory. It would be a good idea, your actuary suggests, to build a management framework recognizing the value of steel in force as an additional asset. Now, however sensible that seems to a life actuary, and I'm conscious that many of you are just that, most industrial firms would find the suggestion more entertaining than practical. And I think actuaries need to wake up and smell the coffee. The outside world does not, and probably will never, understand embedded values. The invention of market-consistent embedded value gives actuaries an excuse to congratulate themselves on making their embedded value creation ever more beautiful. It claims continuity with previous, slightly less mysterious versions of embedded value. And, of course, continuity is great from the point of view of the jobs of actuaries who crunch the numbers. From an outside perspective, it's harder to see why continuity is such an advantage. And beauty, whether of MCEV or anything else, is in the eye of the beholder. On the other hand, we have achieved something very laudable, which is an impressive arsenal of market-consistent valuation tools. And my preference is to continue to extend those tools, particularly in relation to credit risk. Now, let me remind you that when we talk about market-consistent embedded value, what that means in practice is calibrations to interest rates, equity markets, and derivatives on each of those. It's not usually involving a calibration to credit risk instruments. And our hedging construction gives you some idea how we think we can extend it to credit risk and also consideration of frictional costs. But having done that and got that enhanced toolkit that is consistent with credit markets as well as the more conventional markets, my preference would be to apply that toolkit directly to the liabilities. And I think in that sense, and probably one of the few senses in which I actually agree with the International Accounting Standards Board, that's a sensible way to go forward, rather than to go around the rather artificial route, in my view, of revaluing embedded value with yet a more complex methodology. Paul Columbus and others have mentioned the limited liability put option, the option that shareholders have, the default on liabilities. And he's right that the literature places quite a heavy emphasis on this. But we did a lot of numerical work in building this paper up. And we found it pretty difficult to construct an example where that default option was material relative to the contingent loss of franchise value in financial failure. So what that means is that, other things being equal, managers who maximise shareholder value should be risk-averse rather than risk-seeking. Now, that's the opposite conclusion than what you get from much of the finance literature that looks only at the default option and not at the loss of franchise value. So the numerical magnitude of those two is actually quite important for its implications of how you run a firm. But even in theory, this limited liability default option only really affects decisions at very high levels of leverage where the capital is well below regulatory requirements. And in practice, the decision in that situation is very simple. You just have to raise more capital or you won't be allowed to stay in business. So while we accept it would be nice to have an explicit limited liability put option number, it's considerable effort to calculate it, and we question whether that will be repaid in terms of improved decision making. I'd like to comment a little bit on some comments that both Paul Klumpas and Richard McVeigh made about accounting invariance, and I'm grateful to Richard McVeigh for drawing our attention to the Olsen reference, which I'll now go and try and find. They talked about accounting irrelevance, that it doesn't make any difference really how you account, and it's just a matter of timing. And in some ways that's true, but it's not quite true when it comes to the default. And the reason is that the measurement of whether you're allowed to continue trading or not is essentially an accounting measure. And I think that's an important point, because I've lost count of the number of times that people have said to me, you shouldn't focus on accounting principles, you should focus on economic principles. And the underlying idea is that you can somehow abstract from the messy, nasty details of accounting standards and go to a beautiful, intellectually perfect world of economic values. And the reason that doesn't work is that when you get a call from Canary Wharf telling you, I'm very sorry, we're going to close you, they might not be sorry at all, they might say, we're going to close your new business and we're happy to do so because we're protecting customers. But in any case, you get the phone call from Canary Wharf, and at that point you have to stop closing the new business. And their basis for doing that has to be on some sort of accounting measure. So if you're considering how much capital you have to hold, a sensible starting point is to look at the accounting measure which would be used to judge whether you're allowed to continue trading or not. Now, that might not be the accounting measure it seems, because there's a few stops you can pull out in terms of securitizing things and turning inadmissible assets into admissible ones and so on. But in principle, you've got to have some accounting measure under there if you're looking at risk of financial failure. Otherwise, you know, the shareholder equity is always going to be a positive number. You can't go bust by having negative shareholder equity if you include the franchise value in that. I'm going to close with some remarks that pick up what Dick Ray and William Hewitson said about the regulatory implications of cost of capital. And some of you might have been a bit alarmed to hear that regulators were considering introducing the cost of capital as a possible liability. So I thought I'd explain the rationale. In fact, it has already happened that last year end in Switzerland, Swiss firms had to calculate, project 1 year ahead and work out not only the discounted value of their liabilities, but also the cost of the capital which would be required to run those liabilities off. And when you see it in that sense, it does actually make some sense. The regulator doesn't want you to just have enough of the present value. They're arguing that in 1 year's time, after your stress scenario, if you need to get more capital, you don't need to have that capital at that day, but you need to be able to get the capital in order to continue running off the business in an orderly fashion. So logically, it does make sense. However, the numbers that I've seen don't make much sense, and there's a submission from the CRO forum which shows a cost of capital adjustment that seems to increase the liabilities by some small fraction of 1%, which is rather less than the uncertainty in assessing the liabilities in the first place. And it's hard to construct examples where it's material or makes a lot of sense. So what I suspect, actually, is that whichever of William's three alternatives, that is a percentile approach, a cost of capital approach, or an arbitrary risk margin approach, then there's, when a report lands on a regulator's desk to see if claiming that you've got enough capital, there's a relatively small number of options that the regulator has, and they do need to be able to compare companies, and I suspect that that comparison will end up being relative to a list of rules of thumb. Now, I don't think the regulator has any particular access to scientific research that the rest of us don't have, so to the extent that we're using arbitrary rules of thumb in our own businesses, it probably wouldn't be any less arbitrary than the regulator's rules of thumb. So although you've got three approaches which look rather different in theory, one wonders whether in practice you'll end up having the same numbers from all three approaches, and the only effect of the chosen approach is in what rhetoric you have to produce in the 20-kilo report that justifies the answer you've come up with. On that note, I'd like to say thank you again for all your contributions. Thanks for coming, and I hand back to the chairman.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It only remains, ladies and gentlemen, for me to express my own thanks. And I'm sure the thanks of all of us to the authors for the paper. I think we've had a very good discussion here this evening. And I noted a number of challenges going forward for the profession in a number of different areas. So could I ask you to join me in thanking the authors the opener and closer, and all of those who participated in this evening's discussion. Thank you very much. It would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if those who made a contribution could hand any prepared notes to either Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave. I'd also like to draw your attention to the bulletin board that's been set up on our website. These will be available after each session or meeting, and anyone wishing to comment on the paper or elements of the discussion may post their comments here. Can be accessed via the forum heading at the top of the navigation bar as you enter the website. Members will be asked for their user ID, which is their membership number, and their password, which is their date of birth. Also, should anyone wish to claim CPD for attending this meeting, and I remind the actuaries present that the new CPD scheme is coming in from July this year, please sign the forms that will be available in the room at the back after the meeting. Our next sessional meeting, the Institute of Actuaries, will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, 27th of February, when a paper, Living with Mortality, Longevity Bonds and Mortality-Linked Securities, will be presented. I'd now like to invite you all to join in continuing tonight's discussion over a glass of wine in the council chamber at the back. The drinks tonight have been kindly provided by Deloitte, and I declare the meeting closed. Thank you.